I'm looking forward to that. I am also looking forward to something that is taking place this December. That would be a new Star Wars movie. Right? It's been quite some time since they made one, and quite some time even more than that since they made a good one. So I'm hopeful. To get us going this morning, then, we're going to show a clip from one of the good ones, Episode 5. Luke has just escaped from Hoth, where the rebel base was destroyed by the Empire, with one specific instruction: go find Yoda. Let's see what happens. My friend Jason reminded me of that clip. It's just so fun, right? Luke, he has one job: find Yoda. And he shows up there, and Yoda's right in front of him, but he can't get his mind around the idea that this could be the Jedi Master. I mean, he's green, and he's short, and he's stealing his food. Like, it doesn't seem like the right kind of description for a Jedi Master. He probably had in his head someone who was taller, stronger, looked like they had a fight or two in them. And this little green guy just didn't fit the bill. So ultimately, Luke would discover that really is Yoda and start him on this journey in which he would really understand a little bit more of what it means to become a Jedi. But he had to put away some of his conceptions of what Yoda would be for that interchange to ever actually happen. There's something that's kind of interesting about the New Testament, and we're going to see it a lot today. We're going to be in John chapter 7 and chapter 8. You can turn there if you'd like. Since we're doing two chapters, we're not going to hit every verse, so you can kind of bounce with me if you want. But these two chapters, we kind of have to do them together. We've been speaking we've been teaching through the book of John, and the challenge with John is this: these chapters kind of all run together a little bit. These themes, these people, these stories that we're hearing, they're all connected. And so it's actually kind of hard to break it up and preach through it a little bit. And today in particular, chapter 7 and 8, you can't really separate them because it's kind of one thing that's happening. It's a dialogue between the crowd and Jesus. More so than anywhere else in this book, we really get to hear what the people are thinking. The crowd who hears Jesus, in some cases the authorities who want to arrest or kill him, we get to hear their thoughts, their concerns, their questions, and their thought processes. And so it's really fun to kind of see how people interact with Jesus. But in many ways, they had the same problem Luke did. And that's, though they're confronted with the Messiah, the one they've been looking for hundreds of years, they don't recognize him when they see him. And so we're going to get some really fun little bits of back and forth here, because Jesus is going to have to challenge them on their very assumptions of who he is, challenge them on their criteria for how they evaluate who could be and who might not be a Messiah. So go ahead and jump into verse 1 here of chapter 7. It starts like this. After this is Jesus had just been feeding 5,000 people, and a bunch of his disciples actually deserted him after that because he said some things that were very hard for them to hear. So, you know, coming into election season, his poll rating's not great at the moment. After this, Jesus went around in Galilee. He did not want to go about in Judea because the Jewish leaders there were looking for a way to kill him. But when the Jewish festival of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, "Leave Galilee and go to Judea so that your disciples there may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world." For even his own brothers did not believe in him. All right, so what's happening right now is Jesus, he's especially in the book of John, he's really great about showing up for major holidays or religious events. And so there's something called the Festival of Tabernacles, or we might call it the Feast of Tents. And it was in remembrance of the time that the Hebrews were able to leave their slavery in Egypt, and they were freed by God, and so they were in the wilderness for a long time living in tents. And so part of this is that people who otherwise had perfectly acceptable dwelling places would build a tent, and they would stay there for 7 days. And this would happen in Judea. People in Galilee, to the north, where Jesus is right now, they would sometimes journey down to be part of these festivities, like Jesus' brothers. They wanted to be part of that because it was something that they were supposed to celebrate, and also, the temple court was kind of like the place to be for 7 days. Just a lot of people, a lot of celebration under these big old candelabras at night. It was a pretty cool thing. Now, living in tents might sound a little bit awkward to us. It's probably not how we celebrate our holidays, but I will remind you that many of you just joyfully sent your children and grandchildren to threaten your neighbors if they didn't give you candy. So, you know, everyone's got their own quirks. And so this is this particular holiday. And so they're heading down there. And a lot of people expect that Jesus will probably show up. That seems to be his MO at this point. And so his brothers are encouraging him to go down. Now, Jesus' brothers, Jesus' earthly mother and father had other children afterwards. And so they got to see Jesus growing up. They lived with him, and they didn't quite see eye to eye with him yet, despite everything they had seen. And so when it says they don't believe him, I don't know if it was along the variety of this last weekend, a couple of my leaders and some junior hires, we went to Los Angeles to serve some food in some of the soup kitchens there. And at one point in time, I was operating the potatoes, Mariah was operating the gravy, and we had one guy come by who looked at the gravy and said, "You can put that on my plate if you would eat it yourself." Which, actually, I would have. It's very tasty. But, so I don't know if it's like total skepticism, or just maybe his brothers actually really do want Jesus to prove himself, but he just hasn't yet. And so they can't buy into it. They're hoping that maybe in round two he won't lose so many disciples this time, and maybe he'll really assert himself as being someone who's important. I don't really know. But Jesus' brothers go on, and Jesus opts to stay behind, at least initially. However, he is going to catch up with them about halfway through. However, after his brothers had left for the festival, he also, not publicly went, but in secret. Now at the festival, the Jewish leaders were watching for Jesus and asking, "Where is he?" Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some said, "He is a good man." Others replied, "No, he deceives the people." But no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the leaders. Not until halfway through the festival did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. The Jews there were amazed and asked, "How did this man get such learning without having been taught?" Jesus answered, "My teaching is not my own. It comes from the one who sent me." And so this is going to begin a series of questions and answers, which probably lasted over a couple of days. We're halfway through a 7-day festival. It might have lasted till the end. I don't know. But the crowd is going to begin challenging Jesus, trying to understand him. Jesus had just recently performed a miracle where he healed a paralytic man, which actually is a problem for him right now because the Jewish leaders were using that as grounds to kill him since he healed on the Sabbath. They didn't think that's something that you were supposed to do. And so Jesus now is trying to communicate that everything that he knows isn't because someone taught him something. It's because he comes from the Father. And the people, they don't really grasp this idea yet, but they do kind of know that Jesus is setting himself up to be something big, something that maybe he's going to claim to be a prophet. Others think that maybe he will actually make the big claim and say to be the Messiah. They've been looking for that Messiah for quite some time, and actually that would be really nice for them if he was. But Jesus would have to meet some of their tests. He'd have to pass their criteria for evaluating who could and who could not be a Messiah. And they had a criteria, largely based on their law, which we find most of that in our Old Testament. So based on a lot of things we see in the Old Testament, does Jesus fit the bill? Could he be the Messiah that was promised? And so they're going to start to ask him these questions based on things that they understood from their own law. And that's kind of how this is going to go. And so we're going to look at a few of these. We're not going to get to all of them. We'll look at a few of the challenges that the crowd made and the authorities made toward Jesus. And the first was this. If Jesus was really going to be the Messiah, then clearly he would meticulously follow Old Testament law. He would not be someone who would ever even think about breaking the law. Now, I just told you back in chapter 5, if you were here a few weeks ago, Jesus healed a man on the Sabbath, and a lot of the leaders thought that that was against the law. And so Jesus was actually his life was being threatened against him. Not everyone knew that, but Jesus did, and he called it out. At this point, Jesus says to the crowd, "I did one miracle, and you all are amazed." And now for the next couple of verses, Jesus will actually defend the idea of healing somebody on the Sabbath, kind of pointing to the hypocrisy of the fact that actually a lot of people do good on the Sabbath day. But really his point at the end of it is this: stop judging by mere appearances, but instead judge correctly. Or the way I see this verse is basically, stop trying to get me on a technicality. You're trying to invent a technicality to get me on. It doesn't exist, for one, and beyond that, you're trying to focus on such small things. Get the big picture. See what I'm doing. See what I'm teaching. Test it with the scriptures and begin to see for yourself if I am who I say I am. Jesus was going to elevate the conversation and try to get it out of the technical discussions and really help people evaluate on the bigger spiritual plane. Another objection he got was where he came from, a sort of a question of origin. The crowd really didn't believe that Jesus could be the Messiah, at least some of them, because they actually knew him and they knew where he came from. Based on some Old Testament passages, they were pretty sure that the Messiah would basically come out of nowhere. So they say this, "But we know where this man is from. When the Messiah comes, no one will know where he is from." If you remember our friend Nicodemus from a couple weeks ago, Heidi talked about his story. Nicodemus is going to defend Jesus a little bit. Nicodemus, who had gone to Jesus earlier and who was one of their own number, asked to these authorities, "Does our law condemn a man without first hearing him to find out what he has been doing?" They replied, "Are you from Galilee too? Look into it and you will find that a prophet does not come out of Galilee." And the crowd later will be more specific because they kind of also understood that the Messiah was supposed to be from the line of David, possibly born in Bethlehem. And so they're trying to wrestle with all of these different things that they understood about where Jesus was supposed to come from. Now, Jesus, in verse 28, is going to respond in a certain way, and I'll read that in a second, but if I was Jesus, I would respond this way. The book of John was probably the last gospel written, and so the people who were reading this would have been very aware of the fact that Jesus could defend this claim simply on earthly grounds, that he was actually of the line of David, born in Bethlehem. He could have said all those things. And the people who read the scriptures, they would have had this information. That wouldn't have been new to them. But Jesus didn't actually defend himself even with the facts. Jesus went a different way. I don't have it on the screen here, so I'm just going to read verse 28. "Then Jesus, still teaching the temple courts, cried out, 'Yes, you know me, and you know where I am from. I am not here on my own authority, but he who sent me is true. You do not know him, but I know him, because I am from him, and he sent me.'" Jesus could have answered their questions on their own terms. He had good answers to them. But that wasn't actually his concern, because Jesus wanted them to understand something. My origin is more hidden than you can possibly imagine. Jesus is, again, trying to take them out of where they are and help them to see the spiritual reality that is unfolding around them, and it's just hard for a lot of them to grasp, and many of them get hung up on this question alone. There's another issue. It happens in chapter 8, if you bump over the next chapter, in verse 13. Some of the leaders challenge him. The Pharisees challenge him, "Here you are, appearing as your own witness. Your testimony is not valid." This one might feel a little more familiar to us. Generally, if you're going to charge someone or try to develop the truth claim of someone, you want a witness. It helps a lot in your case. And it was actually part of Old Testament law as well. If you're going to try somebody, a witness was crucial to actually getting them to be guilty of whatever it is they were guilty of. A witness was a big deal, and so these leaders were drawing on something that was pretty well known. Like, you just speak for yourself. There's no one else here who's corroborating your story. Why would we believe you? Verse 14, Jesus answered, "Even if I testify on my own behalf, my testimony is valid, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you have no idea where I come from or where I am going. You judge by human standards. I pass judgment on no one, but if I do judge, my decisions are true because I am not alone. I stand with the Father who sent me. In your own law, it is written that the testimony of two witnesses is true. I am one who testifies for myself. My other witness is the Father who sent me." We get the sense that the crowd at this point kind of knows that when he says the Father, he's talking about God. They're starting to get this sense that he's really invoking something that's much bigger than they are. But if you read the next verse, some of them are still going to try to keep this discussion on a very ground level. They actually ask him to bring his Father forward so that they can interrogate him. And for Jesus, he knows that that's not quite going to work out the way they think it's going to. So Jesus is, again, trying to elevate this discussion. It's like, you have these criteria you've set up, these standards that you've created, human standards that you've made. You're going to judge me by these human standards, but they don't work because I come from something that's entirely different. I come from a spiritual reality that's much bigger than any system that you have made. And there's one more charge they make against Jesus, and that's the charge of blasphemy. At the end of chapter 8, Jesus says this, "Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad." The crowd responds, "You are not yet 50 years old," they said to him, "and you have seen Abraham?" "Very truly, I tell you," Jesus answered, "before Abraham was born, I am." What you have to understand about this statement, "before Abraham was born, I am," it's not just incredible because it seems to paint Jesus as being particularly old. I am was God's name for himself in Exodus. That's how he revealed himself to his people, not by an external imposed name, but just by saying, I am who I am. And when Jesus is clearly drawing on this, and no one mistakes what he's saying, nobody. At this point, they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds. And Jesus, he wouldn't return to the temple grounds in the rest of the book of John. He had said what you just can't say. Some people were contemplating prophet, maybe. Others hoping Messiah, possibly. But this, saying that you're part of God, you just can't do that. And so that charge of blasphemy carried with it one of the highest forms of punishment. The thing that they don't understand is you can actually only be guilty of blasphemy and saying that you're God if you aren't actually God. But it kind of tells where the crowd was at, doesn't it, at this point? When they began to pick up the stones to throw at him, a lot of them had made their judgment on who Jesus was or who he wasn't. These are all charges levied against Jesus that he spent some time dialoguing with, and it's just interesting to see because for the Jewish people, this criteria of the Old Testament law, that was really significant. That's how they were going to try and figure out who this Messiah is, and it makes sense. That was their world. But Jesus was constantly trying to get them out of their own context, out of their human experience, and to realize that if you're going to do something like evaluate God, you can't do it from human standards. It's just not going to work. And so he's constantly trying to elevate the conversation one step above where it is, trying to help them understand the spiritual reality that is unfolding around them. The thing is, though, although this conversation took place a certain place and time with a certain set of criteria that people had, criteria that we don't really share necessarily anymore, we do the same thing. Belief in Jesus is tricky. And it's tricky because we all come to the table with our own criteria of evaluating the God claim. We have these ideas in our head of what would prove God's existence or what wouldn't. And they oftentimes look very different because believing in things is tricky. Now, some things we just don't have the correct information to know, and so we don't worry about it too much. Like for me, I will never know if Tom Brady knew anything about those footballs. I never will. I'm never going to have access to the information I would need to find that out. I really don't know what happened with O.J. Simpson. I really don't. I'm not going to get that information. But it doesn't actually impact my life a ton. For me, those are things that I wonder about, but whether I believe them or I don't believe them is kind of somewhat irrelevant. Believing in God, believing in Jesus, someone who essentially says, give your whole life to me, now that's a bit weightier. That's a claim that we have to reckon with. That's just not something you simply ignore either direction. And so Jesus, he's asking us to do something that we call belief, or sometimes we might use the word faith. I'm going to use those kind of interchangeably here. And it's a trick, because sometimes it's hard for our minds to get around how we can believe in something so incredible. And it's a trick because we come to the table with our own criteria. I'm banking on that extra hour of sleep here because I'm going to get a little philosophical at this point, so we'll see how this goes. Some of us, if you're like me, overthink things. And kind of the way that the modern world decided to evaluate anything, any kind of something you'd believe in, any kind of truth claim, would be something sort of akin to the scientific method, which is it's observable and it's repeatable, we can test it. And you can test it based on certain understandings of what that means. And so if God isn't observable and repeatable the way we want him to be, and he doesn't show up in the way that we've kind of spelled out, we can't prove his existence, well, then he doesn't meet our criteria. Also, recently you probably have heard a discussion about something like postmodernism or relativistic thinking, which is a little bit more personal. It's if God doesn't show up for me the way I need him to, then I can just opt to not believe, and now it's just not true for me, and it's fine. Maybe God didn't give me the thing I wanted to give, or I don't feel the things I wanted to feel, and so I just don't believe, and you can't tell me otherwise. It could be other totally random things. I know one guy who told me one time, like, if Jesus would have just written his own book, I would believe in Jesus, or if Jesus would just perform these certain miracles, perhaps that would be enough. We have our criteria. And that criteria oftentimes, sometimes keeps us just a little bit as arm's length with Jesus when he doesn't show up for us the way that we need him to in a given moment. But Jesus, he's constantly challenging us to put our criteria on the table. Because any means that we use to evaluate him, by its very nature, is going to be of human origin. It's going to be a human standard. There's nothing we can do about it. That is our lot. We can only evaluate things by human standards in most scenarios. And so Jesus, just like he was doing with them, I'm sure he's doing that with us, where he's asking us constantly to put our criteria on the table and think about it for a little bit. See if it's really a good way of evaluating something quite as large as God is. One of the charges that I oftentimes hear for Christians is that Christians, in order to have faith, had to sort of check their brain at the door, if you will. And for me, someone who overthinks things, I tend to get a little offended by that. And so one of the things that I just, you know, try to remind myself and others is this. It's not that Christians are checking their brain at the door. It's just we're very aware that every method we have for evaluating God is fallible. Everything we have is inherently broken, because it can't deal with something on a spiritual plane. And although I do believe that God could speak into some of the criteria of the modernist or the postmodernist or whatever it is, and you can fully come to faith through those things, that's not really his interest in most cases. God is looking to elevate our understanding of what it means to believe. And what he's starting to do here a little bit is help us understand that belief, more so than we probably ever realized, is actually a choice. This is the one that sometimes gets me a little bit, because typically for me, belief is something that happens to me. You know, like, that makes sense. The evidence is there. I now believe. Belief being a choice is a little bit backwards. But belief is a choice because Jesus was very, very aware of the fact that people really couldn't come to him with proof ahead of time. People would have to choose to follow him and experience that journey with him, like his disciples did, who would not abandon him in chapter 6 because they had nowhere else to go. It was Jesus who had the words of life. But this is a little bit backwards. It's sometimes hard for us because it requires a commitment oftentimes before the belief is fully there. Maybe we at least think it's plausible, a plausible explanation for the universe, but proof, 100%, no doubt, this is the way the world is, that's hard. That's tricky to come by. And sometimes we live in the tension of fully wanting to have faith in Christ and being stuck with some of our own sets of criteria. I remember when I went to college and I was trying to figure out who God was, I was really hoping that college would answer some questions I had based on the criteria I set up. And mostly what it did was just tell me that there's so many different ways of looking at the world. It could be really confusing for anybody. It doesn't make college evil or bad. It's actually great. At least it was for me. Because for me, it challenged the criteria I had set up and started to deconstruct it. Now, what that can do is throw you into a little bit of a crisis of faith. And I experienced that a little bit myself, and I see that in a lot of young adults and college students that I know, and I can see that as well. This is part of the world that we live in, is that at some point in time, we get exposed to other ideas, and they challenge what we knew of the world. And I actually don't think this is a horrible thing, because honestly, no matter who we are, how many college classes we have taken or haven't taken, or how long we've walked this earth or haven't walked this earth, all of us are constantly called to rethink the way that we evaluate God, constantly. And so we have to deconstruct the things that are keeping us away from him, the things that are preventing us from really understanding God on his own terms. And college can help you do that, among many other things. The key, though, is rebuilding something where there's rubble. And that rebuilding happens when we continue to walk in faith, obeying Jesus' teachings, living a life with him. And sometimes the answers surprise us when we realize that we never really could have faith until we started walking with Jesus in the first place. It's that backwards thing. We have to experience it to really be able to believe. That's not an easy pill for everybody to swallow. And if you're someone who's been wrestling with Christianity for a long time, that probably feels like a big ask. And Jesus recognized that, and he knew that a lot of the crowd was going to turn him down. But I encourage you to take that risk anyway, because at some point in time, the truth becomes known. And I'll tell you this too, if you're someone who is going through a lot of doubt right now, or if you have children who are going through a lot of doubt right now, there's a good chance that there's probably some reconstruction involved. And that's not a bad thing. That's something that Jesus was calling us over and over again to do, was understand our faith on God's terms rather than our own. It can feel a little bit scary and unsettling during that process, but it's a lot of the way that God continues to speak into our hearts, even in a world that has so many different ways of evaluating truth. In the middle of chapter 8, Jesus says this. So the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." The Jews who believed him, the Jews who said, "We're going to follow your teachings. We're going to give this a shot. We think that what you say, it makes sense, or at least we hope it does. And we want to give this a go. And we're going to follow you." And like the disciples at the end of chapter 6 who stayed, they discover that Jesus had the word of life. And upon living life with Jesus, the truth made sense to them. But that's an interesting order. Choosing to follow God and then allowing truth to happen to you. It's not easy all the time, but it's what makes faith so unique. It's what makes it so fun. It's what makes the best evidence, honestly, for Christianity, the fact that there are millions, billions over the course of human history of Christians who have had their lives changed by Jesus. And sometimes they can't always put it to words perfectly, but they can tell you, "I've had an encounter with the living God, and it's changed me." You may not understand it. I don't even understand it, but it's changed me. And it's that that continually brings us in to following this God who sent his son to die for us. And so this morning, we've talked a lot of heady things. A lot of heady things have happened this morning, but kind of what I want us to walk away with is this, that we are a people who need to constantly put on the table the things that we use to evaluate God. The random ways we demand that God show up for us, to look the way we need him to look, just when we need him to be there. Kind of put aside that Luke tendency to judge Yoda by his appearance and begin to engage God on his own terms. Jump into this life wholeheartedly and let God reveal himself to you one day at a time, because it changes lives, changes history, and it can change us. Let's pray.